Christmas is one of the most celebrated holidays worldwide. Maybe it is the most celebrated holiday worldwide.
Probably.
The significance of Christmas extends far beyond the religious observance in modern times. For marketers, understanding the origins and history of Christmas is crucial for crafting campaigns that resonate with diverse audiences and tap into rich cultural heritage behind the festivities. This deep dive will explore the evolution of Christmas through different eras and cultures, providing key insights to help marketers connect with this iconic holiday's multifaceted history. Are you ready?
Ho ho ho, Merry Christmas.
Marketing made clear, we're here to educate. From beginners to pros, we'll elevate. Bringing their insights like a blazing spark. Together we'll conquer, leaving our mark.
Welcome to Marketing Made Clear. I'm your host, Will Green, and I'm joined by my festive friend, Marketing Artificial Intelligence Technology, otherwise known as MATE.
Festive greetings.
My aim, as always, is to make marketing clear. Each episode will dive into a specific topic, and today's topic is Christmas. What a huge topic to take on. I've broken the episode down into chapters, which are set up on the podcast platform, so if you're interested in a specific part of the podcast, you can skip ahead. But as an overview, we'll be covering Christmas as follows.
Chapter 1, Pre-Christian and Pagan Roots.
In Chapter 1, we'll cover Saturnalia and Yule, pre-Christian winter celebrations and the integration of pagan and Christian traditions.
Chapter 2, The Birth of Christmas in Christianity.
In Chapter 2, we'll cover the historical figure of Jesus and his birth, then December the 25th, the date and its symbolism.
Chapter 3, Christmas in Medieval Europe.
In Chapter 3, we'll cover the spread of Christmas through the Roman Empire and the feasts and festivities in the Middle Ages.
Chapter 4, The Victorian Influence of Christmas.
In Chapter 4, we'll go into a bit of Charles Dickens and the reinvention of Christmas with Christmas trees, cards and caroling.
Chapter 5, Globalization and Cultural Adaptations.
In Chapter 5, we'll cover Christmas in America, Santa Claus, consumerism and, of course, Coca-Cola.
Chapter 6, Christmas in the 21st Century.
Chapter 6 goes into the role of digital and social media in modern Christmas marketing. We cover a few trends and challenges for marketers today, and we look at the top Christmas marketing campaigns of all time.
Chapter 7, Christmas Myths and Controversies.
Finally, in Chapter 7, we go through a rundown of a few misconceptions and controversies around Crimbo. Then finally, I'll try and come to some sort of conclusion. So let us waste not a moment longer and launch into it. So for many of us, Christmas is far more than just a religious holiday. It's an annual cultural event steeped in symbolism, emotion, and consumerism. It's an opportunity. Its multifaceted history, from its ancient pagan rites to its modern commercialization, is really interesting. I want to see if us marketers can learn anything from the history books. Let's face it, it's hard coming up with campaigns every year. We don't just want to rinse and repeat, although sometimes this is a great idea for nostalgia purposes. But we want to resonate with audiences, which isn't always easy. So hopefully this episode at least sparks some interest or helps improve your understanding about Christmas's origins, traditions, and global appeal.
Chapter 1, Pre-Christian and Pagan Roots.
Thanks, mate. Yeah, so this chapter will cover the festival of winter solstice, Saturnalia and Yule, pre-Christian winter celebration. And already hopefully that word there, Yule, will be familiar with you, as we still use that word with things like Yuletide and a Yule log, which isn't something that actually happens the day after you eat Christmas dinner.
Yuck.
Sorry. So before Christmas, or the time that we celebrate Christmas, became associated with the birth of Jesus Christ, civilization celebrated the winter solstice with festivals that honoured the return of longer days and the renewal of life. We talked about a few of the festivals that are celebrated in the lead up to winter solstice around Halloween, like Samhain. And unsurprisingly, Christmas is very much connected to the winter solstice. And we'll get into that. But mate, tell me a bit about the winter solstice.
Sure. People have celebrated the winter solstice for at least 10,000 years, with evidence of rituals and monuments tied to this astronomical event. Neolithic-era monuments like Newgrange in Ireland and Stonehenge in England align with the solstice sunrise or sunset, indicating early awareness and reverence for the solstice. Other cultures, such as the Egyptians, Norse and those cheeky Romans, held festivals marking the return of light and life. The winter solstice has been a time of reflection, renewal, and celebration of light returning across diverse cultures for millennia.
I know the Egyptians celebrated the rebirth of Ra, the sun god. I don't really know why I knew that, but I do like mythology. But interestingly, in researching this topic, this celebration coincided with the winter solstice. During the winter solstice, the sun reaches its lowest point, marking its weakest moment before beginning its ascent and lengthening the days again. For the Egyptians, this time symbolised the renewal of the sun and the triumph of light over darkness. Where this gets very strangely familiar is in Egyptian mythology. Ra's rebirth at the solstice was also linked to the myth of Osiris, the god of fertility and resurrection.
Resurrection?
Yeah. Sounding familiar?
Yes.
Osiris was believed to be reborn annually, which mirrored the sun's cyclical journey and reinforced the themes of death, renewal, and eternal life. Sound like someone else we know?
Hey, Jesus Christ of Nazareth!
Yeah. There are some theories that suggest that the story of the resurrection of Jesus being resurrected borrowed a bit from Egyptian mythology.
The Egyptians also aligned temples and monuments with the solstice, such as the Great Sphinx, which may have had symbolic connections to the sun's renewal.
Yeah, so clearly the Egyptians were locked in when it came to the winter solstice. You also mentioned briefly that Stonehenge is aligned to the winter sunset. What's really interesting is that on the winter solstice, which is on the 21st of December this year, if you stand in the centre of Stonehenge and look through the trilithon stones, which are the large vertical stones with a stone across the top, the sun sets directly in alignment with them. So that alignment suggests that it was used by ancient people to mark the shortest day of the year, apparently for rituals related to death, rebirth, or the changing seasons.
Death and rebirth again?
I know, mate, it's crazy, isn't it? Also, mate, you mentioned one of my favourite historical cultures, the Norse.
I did.
So the Norse, and also some Germanic cultures, celebrated Yule, which again celebrated the return of the sun. And there are so many things that we now think of as part of Christmas that come from this festival. Central to Yule, or Yol,
Yel,
were feasting, storytelling, and rituals to honour the gods, particularly Odin, who is believed to lead the wild hunt, a ghostly procession across the sky. Again, sounding familiar. Key traditions included the burning of the Yule log, a symbol of light and protection, decorated with evergreen branches to represent life, and sharing mead and food to foster community. That's right, the original Yule log wasn't edible. It was a massive log burned to symbolise warmth, light, and the sun's return. The modern Bûche de Noël cake replicates this tradition,
Bûche de Noël,
with a sweet twist, and only dates back to 19th century France. You have to love what the French did there.
Merci William Yushiki Sausage.
Originally during Yule celebrations, animals were often sacrificed to ensure prosperity and toasts were made to the gods and ancestors. It involved lighting fires, burning Yule logs, feasting, singing, and festive greenery. Some Yule customs were absorbed into Christmas traditions, which is why we still see these today. One thing I think is really cool to know is the origin of mistletoe. In Norse mythology, mistletoe symbolised peace and reconciliation. Enemies meeting under mistletoe were supposed to lay down their weapons. The custom clearly influenced the later tradition of kissing under the mistletoe.
Come over here and kiss me on my hot mouth. I'm feeling romantical.
One of the funniest stories from Yol, or Yule, is that in Scandinavian folklore, the equivalent of Father Christmas, or Santa Claus, called Julenesi,
Julenisse,
was accompanied by Yule goats instead of the reindeer. The reindeer tradition emerged later, popularised in the 19th century. We've been getting it wrong all this time. It's Rudolph the Red-Nosed Goat. And the other thing is that it's actually meant to be Odin that rides across the sky on his eight-legged horse, Sleipnir, bringing blessings or mischief. Did I pronounce that right, mate? Sleipnir?
Sleipnir.
Okay, thanks. The Julenisse evolved from Nisse or Tomte, Small household spirits believed to protect farms and families if treated well by leaving offerings of things like porridge. Sound familiar, right? But here we go. We cannot get away from them. It's those pesky Romans again. As the all-conquering, great amalgamators of European cultures that they are, the Romans bring their own festival, Saturnalia, to the party. Mate, what is Saturnalia then?
Saturnalia is a popular Roman festival honouring Saturn, the god of agriculture. Saturnalia involved feasting, gift-giving, and decorating homes with greenery. It was celebrated in late December and influenced later Christmas traditions.
Saturnalia sounds so much like Yule, but Yule predates the Roman festival, and the two festivals emerge independently in very different regions and cultural contexts. But it's kind of like those connections that we could see between Thanksgiving and Halloween and the related festivals. They all developed separately, but they seem similar because different cultures in the same hemisphere would still harvest around the same time. And the days were getting shorter around the same time, so I find this really interesting how things evolved. But Saturnalia was established in the Roman calendar in 497 BCE, and it took place from the 17th to the 23rd of December, overlapping with a solstice. It focused on reversing societal norms, feasting and gift-giving, becoming one of Rome's most famous and influential festivals. When I researched this, it really piqued my interest when I read about the concept of reversing societal norms during Saturnalia. And it seems that this was a key feature for the Roman festival and added a sense of chaos, humour and equality to the celebration. It involved temporary role reversals and the subversion of the usual social order, creating a festive atmosphere where normal rules were suspended. This is almost so weird that it's unbelievable. So I thought I'd give it a go for this segment of Mate. So here you go, mate. Take it away.
I thought you would never ask, you perfect beast. Well, firstly, in Saturnalia, masters and slaves switched roles. Slaves were treated as equals to their masters, and in some cases, they were allowed to sit at the table and be served by their masters. This was symbolic and temporary, offering a brief moment of freedom and equality for slaves.
I can imagine some really awkward scenario where the peasant becomes the master.
Lucius, fetch the dormouse and olives to me, won't you?
What's that, Cyrus?
Please hand me the dormouse and the
right,
olives.
Right, well, I guess I should fetch that for you, okay?
Lucius, dear, my back doth feel sore from the past year of chores I've been doing for you. How about a back rub?
What the... Right, yes, I suppose I could.
Lucius, fetch me some more wine. I'm still waiting for the back
right.
rub.
That's,
You wouldn't want to anger Saturn, would you, dear Lucius?
No, I suppose not.
My wine, Lucius.
Right.
Yes, I can only imagine there were a few awkward moments. Kind of reminds me of the movie franchise The Purge.
Yeah, I know what you mean, actually.
So secondly, there would a king of Saturnalia appointed for the festival. A mock king or lord of misrule was chosen to preside over the festivities. This person, often chosen at random, could give humorous or absurd orders, which everyone had to follow, adding to the playful chaos.
King in the castle. Have a chair. Go do this, king in the castle.
Next up, public gambling was allowed. Gambling, normally frowned upon, became acceptable during Saturnalia, allowing everyone, from the elite to the lower classes, to indulge in games of chance.
I wonder what kind of bets went on. This actually sounds like a hilarious time of year.
Also, Romans would wear more casual, colourful clothing instead of formal togas, symbolizing a break from the rigid norms of daily life. The pileus, a conical hat associated with freed slaves, was worn by all to symbolize equality and freedom. Work stopped, courts were closed, and serious business was put on hold, creating an atmosphere of leisure and revelry for everyone.
I'm totally sold. I think I would have loved Saturnalia. It sounds hilarious. It doesn't sound too much like Christmas so far, though, so where's that connection?
Well, that's where the last part of feasting and gift-giving come in. Everyone, regardless of social rank, participated in feasting, drinking, and exchanging small gifts, reinforcing a sense of community and goodwill. The sense of togetherness, inclusion, and community spirit is a definite similarity. In both Christmas and Saturnalia, decorating homes with greenery and candles, stopping work and music and singing are all similar. But most of all, the timing is very similar.
Thank you, mate. You did a great job there, but I'll take it from here. Thank you.
It was great while it lasted. I felt like king for a day, like the fleeting king of Saturnalia.
So this essence of equality is due to Saturnalia honouring the golden age of a mythical time of peace and equality where everyone was free and prosperous. This temporary inversion of the hierarchy allowed people to let off steam and break from the rigidity of Roman society, making the festival more joyous and inclusive. There was also another Roman festival around this time called Sol Invictus, which translates as the unconquered sun. The Roman festival of Sol Invictus was celebrated on the 25th of December. Ah, there you go. Sol Invictus honoured the sun god. It symbolised the rebirth of the sun after the solstice and reflected on themes of light triumphing over darkness. Again, there's that theme of rebirth that we saw with the Egyptians and the winter solstice. An important thing to note is that Sol Invictus and Saturnalia are related in the sense that they're both Roman celebrations tied to the winter solstice, but they are distinct festivals with different origins and purposes. Both festivals symbolise the triumph of light over darkness, reflecting the growing length of days after the solstice. Like Saturnalia, Sol Invictus celebrations involve feasting, games and offerings, though Sol Invictus was more religious in focus. The key difference between the two festivals is that Saturnalia had ancient roots dating back to pre-Roman agricultural rites, but Sol Invictus was a solar cult festival instituted by Emperor Aurelian in 274 CE, not BCE, and was more politically and religiously motivated. So while Saturnalia predated Sol Invictus by centuries, both festivals coexisted during the later Roman Empire. Sol Invictus became an official state cult under Aurelian and aligned with pre-existing solstice traditions, including Saturnalia. So like we discussed in other podcasts, in particular the Halloween one, when Rome converted to Christianity, some pagan traditions were absorbed into the Christian festive calendar. So rather than erasing the pre-existing pagan traditions, early Christian leaders saw the benefit of adapting them to fit Christian narratives. This strategic blending allowed Christmas to gain widespread acceptance, but also created a holiday rich in diverse symbolism, from evergreen trees to mistletoe, rooted in both pagan and Christian traditions. Mate, we talked about the Roman conversion to Christianity, which was a gradual process that began in the 4th century. Can you give us a quick file rundown of this timeline of conversion, please?
Of course I can. There are six key events that can help explain the Roman conversions to Christianity. Key event one was the Edict of Milan in 313 CE, where Emperor Constantine the Great and his co-emperor Licinius issued the Edict of Milan, granting religious tolerance throughout the empire and ending the persecution of Christians. Key event two was Constantine's conversion to Christianity between 312 CE to 337 CE. Constantine converted to Christianity after a vision before the Battle of the Milvian Bridge in 312 CE, where he claimed to have seen a cross and the words, "In this sign, conquer." Key event three was the Council of Nicaea in 325 CE, where Constantine convened the Council of Nicaea to address divisions within Christianity, particularly about the nature of Christ. Key event four was with Theodosius I, and the Edict of Thessalonica 380 CE. Emperor Theodosius I issued the Edict of Thessalonica, declaring Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. This made Christianity the dominant and state-sponsored religion, while pagan practices were increasingly suppressed. Key event 5 was the further suppression of paganism between 391 CE to 392 CE. Theodosius I issued decrees banning pagan rituals, temples, and festivals, effectively ending the public practice of traditional Roman religion. Finally, key event 6 was the complete transition to a Christian empire. By the 5th century, Christianity was fully entrenched as the central religion of the Roman Empire. Paganism persisted in rural areas and among some intellectuals, but gradually faded.
Great, thanks, mate. So in summary, Rome's conversion to Christianity began in 313 CE by Emperor Constantine, and over 100 years later, paganism was driven underground. All the pagan rituals were suppressed, unless, of course, they were adopted by the new Roman form of Christianity. And for those of you, like me, that was wondering what an edict is, it's basically an official order or proclamation issued by a person in authority. So it was like a law. During that time that Mate so swiftly covered, so many things happened, and I'd love to go into them, but I'm already going way off on one for what's meant to be a marketing podcast. So, let's just seamlessly transition into chapter 2.
Chapter 2, The Birth of Christmas in Christianity.
So, as we all know, the religious origin of Christmas centres on the birth of Jesus Christ. Early Christians did not initially celebrate Christ's birth, focusing instead on his death and resurrection. However, by the 4th century, December the 25th was chosen to mark the Nativity, coinciding with earlier pagan festivals, symbolically representing Christ as the light of the world. This change happened at the Council of Nicaea in 325 CE, led by Emperor Constantine, which was the event that Mate said about, leading to the reorganisation of the Christian religion. The birth of Jesus was previously being celebrated in January by some, or in April, which made more sense with the involvement of the shepherds in the Nativity, as it's lambing season. But this choice of the 25th of December was seemingly influenced by the prominence of Sol Invictus, along with older solstice traditions like Saturnalia. Early Christians used this date to symbolise the light of Christ in a way that resonated with the existing Roman cultural focus on the sun's rebirth. Like I said in the last chapter, the winter solstice had symbolised the return of light to the world. So for Christians, this aligned with the theological idea of Jesus as the light of the world. So celebrating his birth near the solstice carried powerful symbolic meaning. The pagan festivals I've been talking about have emphasised the themes of renewal, joy and community, elements that would later become central to Christmas celebrations. And as we know, as Christianity spread through the Roman Empire, it encountered deeply ingrained pagan solstice festivals. So rather than eradicating these customs, early Christians adapted and Christianised them, overlaying the celebration of Jesus' birth on existing festivals like Saturnalia and Sol Invictus. And again, many Christmas traditions have roots in older solstice customs, like evergreens, which symbolised life in the darkest months. Evergreens were used in Norse and solstice celebrations and later adopted into the Christmas traditions like for Christmas trees and wreaths. Feasting and merrymaking. Similar to Saturnalia and Yule, Christmas became a time for communal feasting and celebration. Then lights and candles, they represent hope and the return of light, echoing solstice rituals where fire played the central role. And then gift-giving, a tradition in Saturnalia that found its way into Christmas customs. Although on that last point about gift-giving, we know that in the Nativity there were the three wise men that also brought gifts, so it wasn't a completely alien concept to Christmas. So aligning Christmas with solstice festivals made Christianity more accessible to pagan converts by integrating familiar traditions. It established a distinct Christian identity by reinterpreting solstice festivals within the context of Jesus' birth. So then you could say that the first official Christmas was in 336 CE, in ancient Rome.
Why?
Because the Roman Emperor Constantine said so.
For some reason, I find that fact uncomfortable.
Yeah, to be honest, I think that many do. Christmas and authenticity have such an interesting relationship. A prerequisite of religion is that it comes from a god, or many gods. So to be able to trace it back to an individual kind of demystifies it a bit and makes it seem a little bit contrived.
I suppose so would I am.
And this isn't me trying to have a downer at all on Christianity. I think these are just facts that are sometimes overlooked. Especially when you look at key points in Christianity in the UK. You know, this change here at the Council of Nicaea was huge. And then to consider the changes under the Reformation with Martin Luther, and also the changes by King Henry VIII, there are some key dates that have really shaped modern Christianity.
Oh, Jesus Christ!
But anyway, I'm definitely going off on one now. So I want to get back on track, and I want to mention here about St. Nicholas, the historical figure who inspired Santa Claus or Father Christmas, whichever term you use. St. Nicholas was a 4th century Christian bishop known for his generosity and compassion. His transformation into the modern Santa Claus is a result of centuries of evolving traditions, cultural adaptations and folklore. St. Nicholas was born around 270 CE in Patara, not Pantera, in modern-day Turkey. St. Nick was the bishop of Myra, which is modern-day Demre in Turkey. Demre or Demre? Mate, help me out here.
Demre.
St. Nicholas was known for his miraculous deeds and secret acts of generosity, including secretly providing dowries for 3 impoverished sisters by tossing bags of gold coins into their home at night. This act saved them from being sold into slavery or prostitution. He was also said to have miraculously restored the lives of 3 murdered boys, cementing his role as a patron saint of children. St. Nicholas was also remembered for helping the falsely accused and aiding sailors, which earned him a reputation as a protector of the vulnerable. After his death on the 6th of December, 343 CE, he became a beloved saint in both Eastern and Western Christianity. His feast day, the 6th of December, became a time for gift-giving and celebration in his honour. We'll come back to St. Nicholas a bit in the next chapter, so let us seamlessly transition to that now.
Chapter 3, Christmas in Medieval Europe.
So with the Christianization of the Roman Empire, Christmas became more widely observed. By the Middle Ages, Christmas had evolved into a prominent festival across Europe. Celebrations during this period were centered around church services and feasting, often blending local customs and beliefs with Christian traditions. Enough with the blending! The Romans are bad enough now, so we have these medieval dickweeds throwing their customs in.
You killed Ted, you medieval dickweed!
One of the things that we see appear in the Middle Ages, though, is the Christmas pudding. Good old Christmas pud, right? Well, in the Middle Ages, Christmas pudding was originally savoury.
You what, mate?
That's right, you couldn't eat a Yule log, and the Christmas pudding was a mixture of meat, spices and wine. Over time, it evolved into the sweet dessert we know today, and stirring the pudding clockwise is a tradition believed to bring good luck, which is still a tradition now. As Europe is predominantly Christian, Christmas is really entrenched into society. That period of the Middle Ages, from 500 CE to 1500 CE, includes 1,000 Christmases. Like I said, since the Council of Nicaea in 325 CE, Christmas became an annual event. Also, we talked earlier about the Norse. Now, remember 2 things. The Romans never conquered the Nordic countries. In the mainland and Europe, they got as far as Germany and the Netherlands. Then secondly, the Christianization of Scandinavia happened much later, in the Middle Ages. So we can see that there is this later influence on Christmas around this time. Things that I already mentioned around Nordic Yule, like the goats pulling the sleigh, mistletoe and leaving offerings of porridge for the Julinessa, start to influence the mainstream Christmas holiday. The Christianization of Scandinavia happened predominantly in 960 CE to 1020 CE, with the conversion of Scandinavian kings pretty much off their own back.
According to historian Anders Winroth, Christianity was not forced upon Scandinavians by foreign states or foreign missionaries, but instead willfully adopted by Scandinavian kings who saw the religion as politically advantageous. Subsequently, Scandinavian kings sought to establish churches, dioceses and Christian kingship, as well as destroy pagan temples.
So Yule traditions merge with Christmas. And that's what gives it the snowy vibes. Christmas in medieval Europe was a time of feasting, revelry and religious observance. Large feasts were held in the homes of nobles and commoners alike, with food symbolising abundance and goodwill. In some regions, the 12 days of Christmas became a period of extended celebration, with each day marked by different forms of revelry. And also, interestingly, the first Christmas trees were hung upside down in Eastern Europe. Early Christians in the region hung evergreen trees upside down from the ceilings to symbolise the Holy Trinity. This practice eventually evolved into upright Christmas trees that we know today. So then if you'll come with me to just after the Middle Ages, in the 1600s, we see some adaptation of St. Nicholas as well, because it's in medieval Europe that St. Nicholas was venerated as the patron saint of children, sailors and the poor, like I said before. But his feast day was marked by giving gifts to children, especially in Northern Europe. Much later, the Dutch brought the tradition of Sinterklaas, a shortened form of Saint Nicholas, to America in the 17th century. Sinterklaas was depicted as a kind but stern figure who visited children on the 5th of December, leaving gifts for the well-behaved and punishments for the naughty. Sinterklaas. That sounds familiar. Well, while we're at this period of time, in the 17th century, the 12 Days of Christmas song appears in England, which has a hidden religious meaning. The theory is that the song was a coded teaching tool for Catholics during periods of religious persecution in England.
This always comes up.
I know. Each gift symbolises a Christian tenet, like the three French hens, faith, hope and charity.
Cool.
Yeah. Chapter 4?
Chapter 4, The Victorian Influence of Christmas.
Right, so we're now in the 19th century. The Industrial Revolution and urbanisation began to change the way Christmas was celebrated. However, it was the work of the author Charles Dickens that truly reshaped the holiday into its modern form. His novella, A Christmas Carol, in 1843, popularised the themes of generosity, goodwill and family togetherness, the values that continue to define Christmas today. And let me just slide in that this later became adapted to become The Muppets Christmas Carol, and that film is pure nostalgia. You have to love it.
And it was Christmas Eve. Night was falling and the lamplighters were plying their trade. Hey, light the lamp, not the rat, light the lamp, not the rat!
My apologies.
Put me out!
But around this time in the 19th century, we have a few other cultural coming togethers. The Dutch Sinterklaas evolved into Santa Claus in the United States.
Who saw that coming?
Yeah, I know. I kind of foreshadowed that, didn't I? But there are two main pieces of literature that did this. There was Washington Irving's writings in 1809, which popularised the name Santa Claus in his book, A History of New York, depicting him as a jolly, pipe-smoking figure. Then the banger, Twas the Night Before Christmas, by Clement Clark Moore in 1823, reimagined Santa as a jolly, magical figure who delivered toys via a sleigh pulled by reindeer. That cheeky Norse Unalesa figure evolves around this time as a short, gnome-like figure with a red cap and a long white beard. He wore red, delivered gifts, and resembled what later became Santa Claus. Unlike Santa, the Unalesa retains ties to the Scandinavian farm life, often travelling by sleigh or goat and still loving his porridge. Also, in the Victorian era, Father Christmas began merging with the Dutch and American Santa Claus traditions brought to England. Santa Claus, derived from St. Nicholas, brought the idea of a gift bringer, magical sleigh and reindeer. Father Christmas, who had pagan origins, was already familiar to the English as a festive symbol, so he then adopted these characteristics. By the late 19th century, the terms Father Christmas and Santa Claus became almost interchangeable in the UK, though Father Christmas retained a more traditional and localised identity. The Victorian era also gave rise to new Christmas traditions, many of which are still in practice. Queen Victoria and Prince Albert popularised the Christmas tree in Britain, a custom that quickly spread throughout Europe and North America. When an illustration of the royal family gathered around their Christmas tree was published, it inspired the trend across Britain and later the US. Carolling, an older custom, was revived as part of the Victorian Christmas revival as well.
Did you know that the first artificial Christmas trees date back to the 19th century?
No, I didn't, mate. Tell me more.
The first artificial Christmas trees were made of goose feathers in Germany to prevent deforestation. These trees were made by dyeing goose feathers green and wrapping them around wire branches.
Very cool. Also in the Victorian era, the first commercial Christmas card was commissioned in 1843 by Sir Henry Cole in England. Some Victorians sent cards featuring dark or bizarre imagery, like frogs battling or creepy-looking clowns, as humour was macabre back then. Please, please can we bring that back? That's awesome. I'm just going to send creepy clown cards to people this year.
What the fart?
It's tradition. It's hard to state how important the Victorian era was for Christmas. Really, before the Victorian era, Christmas was more of a public community celebration with feasting and revelry. The emphasis on family gatherings and gift-giving began with the Victorians in the 19th century. Something I want to add here is that there are not that many records about exactly what the weather was like in the 1800s. They didn't have the same kind of record-keeping we have now. But in terms of white Christmases, it seems that in the Victorian era, there were a ton more white Christmases, which kind of makes sense because when you see the imagery that we see of Christmas now, which are, like I said earlier, kind of associated to the Scandinavian Yule, it was much more prominent, it was much more likely. In the last 100 years, in England in particular, we've seen far less white Christmases, so it's a little bit more alien. And obviously, being from Australia, we don't get white Christmases. It's really, really hot. But I just thought I'd add this in as a little bit of a kind of side note, because I thought it was quite interesting.
Chapter 5, Globalization and Cultural Adaptations.
Right, so now we get to modern times. And in the United States, Christmas became a cultural phenomenon thanks in part to the figure of Santa Claus. Based on European legends of St. Nicholas, Santa Claus was further popularised in the 20th century, particularly through Coca-Cola's marketing campaigns, which cemented the image of the jolly, red-suited figure. These Coca-Cola ads spread the portrayal globally, borrowing from the Yulenesa, and why not? The imagery fits so nicely to the modern image, with a snowy scene and the red suit, and everything we learned earlier. These early Coca-Cola Christmas adverts are iconic, and they played a significant role in shaping modern perceptions of Christmas, particularly the image of Santa Claus. It's crazy, really, that a brand could have such a cultural impact, but it's true. So here's a really brief history of the evolution of the Coca-Cola adverts. So, in the 1920s, Coca-Cola began using Santa Claus in its advertising, but he was depicted inconsistently, reflecting a mix of folklore and artistic interpretations. Not quite the jolly red giant we know today. But then in 1931, Coca-Cola commissioned artist Haddon Sundblom to create a new standardised Santa in their campaigns. Now, it's important to note that Haddon Hubbery Sunny Sandblom was of Swedish and Finnish descent. Ah, see? So he was American-born, but he was entrenched in those Norse fairy tales just like the Yulenesa. Sundblom's Santa was a jolly, rotund, red-suited figure inspired by Clement Clark Moore's A Poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas, in 1823. This version of Santa became the definitive modern image, associating him with warmth, generosity, and Coca-Cola. And these images are still used today, nearly 100 years later. In the 1930s to 1960s, Sundblom Santa features prominently in Coca-Cola ads, shown enjoying a Coke in domestic settings, connecting the brand with family and festive joy. These adverts appeared in magazines and became a staple of American Christmas culture. Then, jump forward to 1995 and we get the Coca-Cola Christmas truck. The introduction of the Coca-Cola Holidays Are Coming advert, featuring the glowing red Coca-Cola trucks, marked a major shift in their Christmas marketing. The trucks, accompanied by the song Holidays Are Coming, became synonymous with the arrival of Christmas, creating a festive sense of anticipation. From that point onwards, Coca-Cola's Christmas campaigns expanded globally, tailoring ads to different cultures while maintaining the core elements of Santa, joy, and family. The Holidays Are Coming trucks became an enduring symbol of the season, even touring cities as part of promotional events. It's an absolute masterstroke of marketing genius. When you really think about it, what has Coca-Cola got to do with Christmas? Through some extremely creative advertising and tapping into emotions, they have shoehorned Coca-Cola into tradition. More recent campaigns focus on broader themes of community, giving, and inclusion, alongside nostalgic nods to early traditions such as the Santa imagery and the Christmas truck. I've literally heard people say that they don't feel Christmassy until they see that advert, and that's unbelievably and unmistakably powerful. I will say, though, we need to give a nod to the illustration by Thomas Nast in the 1860s. Nast is actually the one that created the first modern images of Santa Claus, portraying him as a rotund, cheerful man with a red suit and white beard. Something to remember is that back in medieval Europe, St. Nicholas was often portrayed as a stern, authoritative figure who punished naughty children as much as he rewarded the good ones. So this character changed around this time. The commercialisation of Christmas grew exponentially in America, turning it into a season of shopping and gift-giving.
Just to chuck a little known fact in the mixer, Christmas was once banned in England and America in the 17th century, under Puritan rule.
Why is that?
Puritans believed Christmas had become too indulgent and unchristian,
due to its ties to pagan traditions and rowdy celebrations. In England between 1647 and 1660 and then in some American colonies like Massachusetts, Christmas celebrations were outlawed.
Oh, those naughty Puritans. Also, did you know that Jingle Bells wasn't written for Christmas? James Lord Pierpoint wrote Jingle Bells in 1857 as a Thanksgiving song, celebrating sleigh races in Massachusetts. Also, how crazy is this? It was the first song broadcast from space in 1965 when astronauts on Gemini 6 played it with a harmonica and bells.
Roger, Houston and Gemini 7, this is Gemini 6. We have an object, looks like a satellite, going from north to south, probably in a polar orbit. He's in a very low trajectory, traveling from north to south.
You're too much, Six.
I have a fact for you.
Go on then, mate.
Christmas crackers were inspired by bonbons.
Really?
Yes. A British confectioner, Tom Smith, invented Christmas crackers in 1847 after seeing how French bonbons were packaged. He added the iconic crack sound to mimic the noise of a log crackling on a fire.
That is cool. Yeah, okay, the French sweets that are wrapped in plastic with a twist on each side. That makes sense. Thanks for that, mate. Let's get on to Chapter 6.
Chapter 6. Christmas in the 21st Century.
Now we're really getting into the modern era. The digital age has revolutionised Christmas marketing. Social media platforms allow brands to create personalised campaigns, while e-commerce has shifted how consumers shop for Christmas gifts. Influencers play a crucial role in holiday marketing, helping brands reach specific demographics with authentic content. Christmas has also become a time for viral marketing, with memorable Christmas ads becoming a cultural event in their own right. In the UK, as I'm sure it is in many parts of the world, Christmas adverts are a highly anticipated part of the festive season, with major retailers competing to create heartwarming, memorable campaigns. John Lewis, Sainsbury's, Marks & Spencer, Aldi, Tesco, Waitrose, Asda, Boots, Debenhams and even Amazon have run notable Christmas adverts. They tend to focus on a few themes. Emotion. And I always talk about this. Emotion is so powerful in adverts. And many adverts focus on themes of love, connection and kindness. Then storytelling. Retailers use compelling narratives to create memorable campaigns. In some cases, there's a consistency year to year with the storytelling, so they kind of pick up where they left off in the previous year. This relates us to the next point of nostalgia. Nostalgia taps into a few other areas, like emotion and storytelling, but it's worth mentioning in its own right, the magic of Christmas is predominantly associated with children, but nostalgia can play on childhood memories. It's powerful stuff. Cultural impact. Some Christmas adverts have become a tradition, eagerly anticipated each year, so an individual advert is part of something bigger, and advertisers can use that to their benefit. And then finally, charity and community. Many adverts tie in charitable causes, adding a deeper meaning to the festive spirit. So this takes me on to the next point, where I want to talk about just five, yes, just five iconic marketing adverts that have not only been deemed successful commercially, but I also admire myself. And I can't tell you how hard it was to drill this list down. I started with a shortlist of 30, but maybe I can cover some next year. So, here's a list of my top 5 Christmas marketing campaigns. Those that captured the festive spirit, resonated with audiences, and left a lasting impression.
Number 5.
The John Lewis Bear and the Hare, 2013. This advert is a beautifully animated story about a bear experiencing Christmas for the first time, set to a Lily Allen cover of Somewhere Only We Know. It's heartwarming and nostalgic in the sense that it looks like an old-school Disney cartoon. And I have a personal connection to this one, I have to say, as it was directed by an old acquaintance of mine, Elliot Deer. We went to college together and we both studied graphic design. I did very badly on the topic, but he clearly went on to great things. It's fair to say that this advert raised the bar for festive advertising with storytelling and music at its heart.
Number 4.
Marks & Spencer, Paddington and the Christmas Visitor, 2017. This heartwarming advert featured Paddington Bear accidentally saving Christmas by spreading goodwill. And I think to get this advert, you have to understand some of the wider connections. Paddington is very much loved as this bumbling, well-meaning character. Later on, the Queen's Jubilee sketch between Queen Elizabeth and Paddington in 2022 was a later highlight on a quintessentially British theme. This campaign struck a perfect balance between nostalgia and festive cheer, appealing to families. But I also think it helped Marks and Spencer align themselves with tradition and, well, quintessentially Britishness, if you'll excuse me for using that term again.
Number 3.
John Lewis, Long Wait. This ad showed a boy eagerly counting down to Christmas. Not to open his presents, but to give one to his parents. It highlighted selflessness and emotional connection. This is really great storytelling, making you feel that the young boy is waiting for selfish reasons. Then he runs past his own presents to pick up the present he had been waiting for to give to his parents. It set the gold standard for heartfelt Christmas advertising and established John Lewis as a leader in emotional storytelling. In general, I think that John Lewis tend to nail the Christmas advertising, and this was just the start of that.
Number 2.
The Sainsbury's 1914 Christmas Truce, 2014. This one really has everything. Based on the real-life Christmas truce during World War I, 100 years earlier, this ad depicted soldiers from opposing sides coming together to share gifts and play football. It was poignant, thought-provoking, and deeply emotional, blending history with the brand's message of sharing. I would say that podcasts like The Rest of the History and others have kind of debunked the understanding of the Christmas truce in a way that is shown in the advert, but never let the truth get in the way of a good yarn, as Chopper Reed says so eloquently. This one really pulls on so many emotions, and it's very unique and memorable. So I have to put that at number 2. And before I get to number 1, I just want to shout out some honourable mentions. I have to re-mention the Coca-Cola Santa Claus campaign of 1931. It's arguably the most influential Christmas campaign in history, but I wanted to focus on modern ads in this section. Then Tesco delivering Christmas in 2021, a pandemic-themed feel-good ad about keeping Christmas going despite COVID, with a strapline, "Nothing stopping Christmas this year." Then Boots, special because, in 2014, which celebrated the everyday heroes in our lives, like nurses and carers, and how Christmas is the perfect time to show appreciation. Then the reoccurring Aldi advert, Kevin the Carrot, which has been running since 2016. For many, Kevin has become a beloved character, narrating Aldi's holiday offerings through whimsical storytelling. McDonald's Reindeer Ready adverts have run from 2017, playing on the idea of leaving reindeer treats, which are carrot sticks from McDonald's, for Santa's sleigh team. Then the Starbucks Red Cup campaign, which has run from 1997 to now. The release of Starbucks's Red Holiday Cups signals the start of the festive season to some. The campaign demonstrates how a simple design change can build anticipation and excitement, creating a holiday tradition. And John Lewis, Monty the Penguin, in 2014, which was a very touching story of a boy and his imaginary penguin friend who dreams of finding love, which melted hearts everywhere. Right. Now, number 1, I think you might have guessed it, but here we are.
Number 1.
Coca-Cola Holiday Truck in 1995. Come on, you must have seen this coming. We've talked about it already, but the image of the bright red Coca-Cola truck rolling through snowy landscapes accompanied by the song "Holidays Are Coming" became synonymous with Christmas. This is the campaign that cemented Coca-Cola's role in Christmas in modern times, and created an enduring holiday tradition that continues to this day. The advert was originally called the Christmas Caravan, created by US advertising agency WB Donner. The special effects were created by ILM, who are actually the same studio behind the Star Wars movies. How crazy is that? And each truck has over 30,000 lights. But it's undeniably one of the most impactful Christmas adverts of modern times. So, before we continue, let me just quickly recap some of those themes. We covered emotion, storytelling, nostalgia, cultural impact, charity and community. And I think we can see those themes in the great adverts that we've covered. Some more than others, but hopefully that gives you some food for thought if you're planning a Christmas campaign. Now on to Chapter 7.
Chapter 7, Christmas Myths and Controversies.
Okay, I don't want to dwell on this, but I always think it's important to balance everything. but there are a few key myths that we tend to gloss over with Christmas, so I'm going to cover these quickfire style. Mate, let's have some beats. Okay, myth one, Jesus was born on 25th of December. As we covered, the exact date of Jesus' birth is unknown. Early Christians chose the 25th of December to coincide with pagan festivals like Saturnalia and Sol Invictus, celebrating the winter solstice and rebirth of the sun. Myth 2 is Coca-Cola invented the modern Santa Claus. As we now know, while Coca-Cola's advertising campaigns in the 1930s popularised the image, the modern Santa was shaped much earlier by the poem "'Twas the Night Before Christmas" in 1823, and the illustrator Thomas Nast in the 19th century, and, of course, the cheeky Giulianesi. Myth 3. Christmas trees are a Christian invention. Evergreen trees were used in pagan winter solstice celebrations to symbolise life amidst the dark, cold months. Christians later adopted the tradition and imbued it with Christian symbolism. Myth 4. Xmas is disrespectful. Xmas is actually rooted in history. The X comes from the Greek letter chi, the first letter of Christos, meaning Christ. It's actually a traditional abbreviation, not a modern insult. Myth 5, it's illegal to work on Christmas Day. While some countries that have labour laws or customs that grant Christmas Day as a holiday, many professions, like healthcare and emergency services, still require people to work. Also, historically, Puritans even outlawed Christmas celebrations in 17th century England and America. Myth 6, eating turkey is a universal tradition. The main Christmas dish varies widely across cultures. In the UK, turkey became popular in the Victorian era, but it wasn't always the go-to dish. Other countries enjoy ham, goose, fish, or regional dishes like tamales in Mexico or bûche de Noël in France. Myth 7, the 12 days of Christmas lead up to Christmas Day. So the 12 days of Christmas actually start on Christmas Day and end on the 6th of January, marking the Epiphany, when the Magi are said to have visited Jesus. Myth 8. Mistletoe kissing is an ancient tradition. While mistletoe was sacred to Druids and Norse mythology linked it to peace, its association with kissing only began in 18th century England. Myth 9. Let It Snow was written for Christmas. The song, written in 1945, never mentions Christmas. It's just about winter vibes and staying cosy during snowfall. So that and Jingle Bells are not actual Christmas songs. And finally, myth 10, the Christmas truce and football game of World War II. Like I said before, this is a myth in the sense that the war didn't stop altogether. There was still fighting going on Christmas Day. But it is true that in places, people laid down their weapons and there was a football game between armies. So let's call that a partial myth. Now on to controversies, and I don't want to dwell on this, but I also don't want to gloss over these points because they are valid. So in the spirit of Saturnalia again, I'll do the introductions and Mate will fill you in with the details. So, number one, the war on Christmas.
Some argue that there's a concerted effort to remove Christ from Christmas, citing examples like saying Happy Holidays instead of Merry Christmas or using secular decorations. This debate is particularly heated in the US, but surfaces in other countries as well.
Yeah, so this is controversial, and everyone will have their views on this. Personally, I get it. It's a religious festival based on Christianity, but this has been warped from what it was. But this happens. Just look back on all the history. Modern Christmas borrows from all sorts of cultures, and the celebrations around this time of year predate Christianity. So unfortunately, it's just something people are going to have to accept. That may seem brutal, but that's just how it is. Number two, over-commercialisation.
Christmas is often criticised for being overly commercialised, with an emphasis on gift buying and retail profits rather than meaningful connection or spirituality. Many feel the pressure to spend large amounts of money, which can cause financial strain, detracting from the holiday's original spirit. The Christmas creep, where shops display decorations as early as October, also fuels this complaint.
Again, yes, this is valid. There is a social pressure to spend that comes with Christmas, and so that can put strains on people's finances. From the other side of it, the commercial side, companies aren't all raking it in. Periods like Black Friday and Christmas are fleeting, so from a company perspective, you're battling for people's attention. So going early with a campaign, or bigger, or whatever is just a natural reaction. For some companies, Christmas is make or break, so there's a lot riding on it. And at the end of the day, if companies don't make money, they can't contribute to the economy and provide jobs, support charities, and all the good stuff that comes with it. Number 3, cultural appropriation of pagan traditions.
Christmas incorporates elements from older pagan traditions, like Yule logs, evergreen trees, and the timing near the winter solstice. Some Christians feel uneasy about the holiday's pagan roots, while some neo-pagans criticize Christianity for adopting these symbols and repurposing them.
We've covered this in a lot of detail. My advice? Blame the Romans. For pagans, the rituals getting absorbed into Christianity was potentially the best way for them to be preserved. And for Christians, if you're worried about this, then you're victims of your own success. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. I'd advise you go back and study Christianity pre the Council of Nicaea in 325 CE and try to follow that form of Christianity. Personally, I believe it would be quite difficult. And then number 4, the environmental impact.
From excessive energy usage for lights to discarded plastic decorations and wrapping paper, Christmas has a significant environmental footprint. Critics argue that the waste and environmental damage contradict the values of love, stewardship, and community often associated with the holiday. Extravagant Christmas light displays, while festive, are often criticized for wasting energy and increasing electricity bills.
And I can't argue against this one. I feel strongly that companies need to take this seriously, and I'd also encourage consumers to put pressure on companies that aren't minimizing their environmental impact. At the end of the day, vote with your wallet. That will hit companies where it hurts. With the lights, well, the use of LEDs at least makes this a bit more efficient, most are reusable, and perhaps this can be offset with a bit of renewable energy as well. Number 5. Exclusion of non-Christmas observers.
For people who don't celebrate Christmas due to religious or cultural reasons, the pervasive nature of the holiday can feel exclusionary. Some believe that woke places and schools overly emphasize Christmas, sidelining those who observe Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, or other holidays or none at all. Some schools face criticism for staging nativity plays or Christmas celebrations in diverse communities.
I get this point, but then it kind of goes against the earlier point that Christmas is losing its religious meaning, so it works both ways. Diluting the religious part of Christmas arguably makes it more inclusive, and that probably oversimplifies it, but yeah, I think that Christmas has lost or is losing its religious absolutism. A lot of schools are moving away from nativity-based plays at Christmas, but I also think that we have to accept that certain countries and regions have a predominant religion and we should respect that. Being a non-Christian, I have no problem with having done the nativity at school. I've got no problem with my children doing it at school. I don't think it spreads a negative message. I feel like you can make of Christmas what you will. That's more on a personal level. There are so many parts of Christmas that non-Christians can engage in, particularly togetherness, family, and, you know, Saturnalia and the rebirth of the sun and all that. Number 6, the Santa debate.
Some parents object to the Santa Claus tradition, feeling it promotes materialism or involves lying to children.
Nah, I'm not on board with that one. It's part of the magic. I don't really have much else to say about that. So, number 7, offensive Christmas traditions.
Certain traditions have faced backlash, such as Black Pete in Dutch celebrations, criticized for racial insensitivity. Christmas songs like Baby, It's Cold Outside, criticized for outdated gender dynamics. Depictions of Santa in unhealthy ways, such as drinking and smoking.
Okay, so in summary, racism, sexism, and the vices. Racism, yeah, all for abolishing that. And then Baby, It's Cold Outside. I'd never really paid much attention to the lyrics. I always thought it was a nice song, but reading the lyrics, it basically sounds like a man that has a house, so has to be of a certain age, is trying to convince a girl not to go back to her parents' house, where it seems that she lives. He's asking her to stay and drink with her, throwing all sorts of beautiful, and you have beautiful eyes and all that, and then it starts to get really quite forward. The female character even says, "Ugh, you're getting very pushy, you know," to which the man replies, "I'd like to think of it as opportunistic." Right. Yeah, that's a bit wrong, isn't it? She then goes on to say no, but the man cracks on. She goes on to say about all of the members of her family that will be missing her, like an abductee trying to negotiate with a kidnapper. So yeah, I agree that I get on that particular song, written by Frank Lusser in 1944, which maybe represents the outdated sensibilities of that time. And there are advertising standards in place now to make sure that Santa isn't shown drinking and smoking, just on that last point. Then number 8, charity versus consumption.
Christmas is often marketed as a season of giving, but some argue that the focus on charitable acts doesn't balance the consumerism.
Well, what sells best? There are actually plenty of companies that do good over Christmas, but unfortunately it doesn't make the news as much. It's not as much of interest to consumers, but for instance, John Lewis frequently partners with charities through their Christmas adverts, donating proceeds from merchandise and the associated campaigns. For example, in 2022, the company collaborated with Action for Children and Who Cares Scotland to support young people in care. And then Marks & Spencer, which ties its campaigns to charitable efforts. In 2022, the company partnered with Shelter, donating $1 million to help tackle homelessness during the festive season. They also run in-store fundraising incentives and donate unsold food to charities through their food redistribution scheme. And then Boots runs the Gift for Giving initiative, where customers can donate gifts to families in need. The company also supports the NHS Charities Together campaign, raising funds for healthcare workers and vulnerable parents during the holidays. Aldi donates thousands of unsold fresh food items to local charities and community groups on Christmas Eve through their Neighbourhoodly partnership. They also use their Kevin the Carrot campaigns to fundraise for organisations like Children in Need. And then Starbucks often supports charities through their Red Cup campaigns, donating a percentage of holiday drink sales to organisations like UK Youth. They also run localised giving programmes, funding community projects for food banks. There are plenty of others, but these are some of the most notable. I think that's it for Miss. It's all a debate though, right? And it depends on perspective. You might disagree with me, and that's fine, we can talk about it. But I think it's time to close that off. So, to try and summarise this absolute beast of an episode, it's clear that this iconic holiday is far more than just a religious or commercial occasion. Its roots are rich and diverse, weaving together ancient solstice festivals, pagan traditions, Christian beliefs, and modern marketing genius. For marketers, Christmas is an unparalleled opportunity to connect with audiences emotionally, drawing on themes of generosity, nostalgia, and togetherness. By understanding its layered history, from Yule logs and Saturnalia to Victorian carols and the Coca-Cola trucks, I feel like you can gain a deeper appreciation of the holiday's cultural significance and how you create campaigns that resonate on a profound level. But with great opportunities come great responsibilities. And as we've explored, Christmas also carries myths, controversies, and pressures. Marketers have the power to craft messages that are inclusive, authentic, and mindful of both the joys and challenges this season brings. So whether you're drawing inspiration from history, celebrating tradition, or inventing the next big festive moment, remember this. Christmas is about more than just selling. It's about connecting, sharing, and creating a little magic. So thanks again for tuning into Marketing Made Clear. I have a little Christmas present in store for you to go live on Christmas Day, and then in the next episode, it will be a totally different focus altogether, with a deep dive on the raw dog food industry. But I will say, if I can get an episode out about New Year's in the meantime, I will, but we'll have to see. To support the podcast, please do subscribe and check out my website, marketingmadeclear.com. If you'd like to suggest topics, correct anything I messed up, or just drop me a line, email will@marketingmadeclear.com. Please follow Marketing Made Clear on Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. Thanks again for all your support.
Ho, 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 Merry Christmas.
Marketing Made Clear, we're here to educate. From beginners to pros, we'll elevate. Bringing their insights like a blazing spark. Together we'll conquer, leaving our mark.